Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Mandela is in.
That's why today I'm proud to announce my campaign for the United States Senate.
AG calls update on clergy abuse investigation.
NBA champions once again.
And the Bucks and Six. Was the state investment in the Deer District worth it? This plus WISPAL stock picks, all on Rewind, your week in review for July 23rd.
Hi, I'm Jessica Van Egren.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And this is Rewind, your week in review for the week of July 23rd. We're going to start out our conversation today with news that a lot of us thought was coming. We talked about this last week. Lieutenant Mandela Barnes is officially in the race for U.S. Senate. Why is he running? Unlike other candidates, Barnes really focused on more than simply spelling out why Ron Johnson should run. His campaign video that came out was Slug Changing the Game, basically emphasizing ways that the system isn't working for everyone in Wisconsin. I also liked how he gave a nod to freedom fighters in his announcement, drawing on the past and things other black men and women had done in the state, historic things in the state of Wisconsin. I'm guessing that his attacks will, or those who don't want him to win, will focus on some of his political missteps. A GOP nickname for him is already Make It Up Mandela. So I thought we could start there, JR, just what you make of this news and maybe some strengths, weaknesses of Mandela, and kind of just were you surprised that he announced?
Oh, no. This has been coming for a while. Yeah. He's been building up toward it. Like, the conversation about the Senate field for a long time has been if or when Mandela got in, he would be a front runner right away. Mm-hmm. Well, now for Mandela, the challenge is to prove it's not just like hype, that it's for real, that he deserves to be a front runner. Now, we're up to 10-ish candidates. There's one still thinking about it, but we think he's going to be in anyway. We're at about 10 people running for U.S. Senate right now. There's clearly a top tier. That top tier is Mandela Barnes, Sarah Godlewski, the state treasurer, mm-hmm. and Alex Lazary, who's on leave of his job with Milwaukee Bucks exec. Now, there's also Tom Nelson, who's trying to elbow his way into that top tier as a candidate. For Mandela now, you look at like the fundraising numbers we talked about last week. Lazary raised $1 million again for the second quarter. He's banked about $1 million, about halfway raised. Mm-hmm. He's not so far ahead financially that Barnes couldn't catch him. Same with Godlewski. She banked about $250,000 off the $500,000 she raised. Nelson's got $400,000 in the bank. There's room to catch up for Barnes financially. He's got to take the endorsements he's getting now, turn them into money, infrastructure, those kinds of things. Now, the challenge is, we're talking it's late July in an off year. This is not a great time to raise money. people, I think, sometimes go, oh, their money's always prevalent in politics, but there are times donors don't want to give or are kind of like, yeah, maybe hit me up later on. And, oh, by the way, such a crowded field, I'm not sure where I want to go with my resources. So how does he, what's his window to raise that money and build that infrastructure and prove that he is really a top tier? Is it this quarter, mm-hmm. the next 6 months, next 9 months? I mean, the race is still a year and 3 weeks away, 2 weeks away. So
next
he's got
August.
Some time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's take a quick look at a clip of Barnes making his announcement official on Tuesday in Milwaukee.
I'm running for the Senate to provide opportunity to fight for hardworking people just like my parents and so many other people across this entire great state. I'm running to build on the legacy of those brave freedom fighters who came before me, who stood up for our most basic rights. I'm running because it's time for Wisconsin to do big and bold things once again. When we lift up families in Milwaukee, it helps farmers in western Wisconsin. When we fight for the mill workers in the Fox Cities, the benefits are felt from Janesville all the way to Superior. When we build an immigration system that values justice and treats all people with the dignity that they deserve, we ensure a better life for everyone. I know that we can build a future right here in the state of Wisconsin where the doors of opportunity are wide open for anyone with a dream and the passion to carry it forward. I want you to look at this as day one on that journey, Wisconsin. We have to lead with our values, we have to lead with our vision, and we have to change the game. Thank you.
The next topic we're going to address is the Department of Justice's update on the clergy abuse scandal. Earlier this week, Attorney General Josh Call held a press conference saying that the response he's been receiving from the state's five Catholic dioceses has been, quote, an uneven response. Four of five said they would participate in a statewide investigation. That was according to a Green Bay Press Gazette article from last year, but that's not happening. Milwaukee Diocese, for example, are challenging the Department of Justice, saying the investigation has, quote, unreasonably broad scope. That said, more than 100 reports of abuse have been received since Call launched his investigation in April. Many are beyond the statute of limitation. Those cases will be sent to local DAs, and Call declined to say how many of the more than 100 cases have been referred to local DAs so far. I think worth noting is Sarah Peterson, the associate director of NATE's mission, which is a Wisconsin-based project of the group Ending Clergy Abuse, said she found the participation from state dioceses disheartening but not surprising. So wanted to talk to you, JR. Obviously, this is a very sensitive topic. Mm-hmm. The church has arguably a lot of power in this if they're choosing not to participate. But Call is responding from outreach from victims, especially a victim that was in the Green Bay area that really received a lot of attention and kind of pushed this forward. So what do you make of this for him? Is this, like, politically speaking, for him to take this on?
Oh, remember, the Milwaukee Archdiocese said it wasn't going to participate and also accused Call of the investigation having anti-Catholic bias at mm-hmm. the time. So
yeah.
there's some definitely some touchy subjects for Call politically. Now, on the one hand, the Catholic Church in Wisconsin is still a fairly big operation in terms of, like, membership mm-hmm. and voters.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
if you're taking on the church, you could be put you in a politically different, difficult situation. On the other hand, if you are somebody who's Catholic and has an issue with how the church has handled the abuse scandal, you're probably more open to Call than somebody who's defending the church in
mm-hmm.
this. So we'll see how that plays out. The thing is, we've watched for two decades
mm-hmm.
this play out, the question about statute of limitations with abuse allegations, how to handle these things. It has been a slow slog. There's not much progress legislatively. There have been mm-hmm. a few bills that have kind of come up over the years. I don't know if Call's investigation is going to make serious headway in that issue,
mm-hmm.
but it's obviously drawing some complaints. The question is, what does it do going forward? What resolutions can it offer people, especially outside the statute of limitations? What's that going to mean?
Do you know off the top of your head what the statute of limitations is for
the... I can't remember.
Okay.
But what's that going to mean going forward? And then again, what's the resolution? And how is this tied up? And what's the kind of going forward, what's going to happen?
Yeah. So we'll... send this off to a clip real quick from a press conference where Josh Call was earlier this week to hear him talk about it just a bit.
So as I said when we launched this initiative to survivors of clergy and faith leader abuse, we hear you and we know how important this review is, and the Wisconsin Department of Justice is committed to pursuing accountability and to working to prevent future cases of abuse. Overall, between diocese and religious orders, I would say that the response has been uneven. And it's part of the reason that these reports are so critically important. It's clear that there continue to be survivors who are suffering trauma as a result of clergy and faith leader abuse. You know, about a year and a half ago or so, there was reporting from the Green Bay area about somebody who alleged that he had been abused by three faith leaders who committed suicide. And that case is representative, I think, of a lot of other people who are survivors, who are facing trauma, who haven't had a statewide response that fully analyzed this, worked to get accountability, and worked to connect survivors to services. And that's exactly what we're doing here. We're providing a trusted and safe place for survivors to be connected to services if they would like, and to report so we can get as comprehensive a review as possible.
Opioid abuse has been a big problem across the United States for many years now, and today, or this week, there was big news that a $26 billion opioid settlement had been reached. Wisconsin's cut of that settlement is $400 million. This settlement covers more than 4,000 cases involving opioid abuse across the country. how this money breaks out. Three distributors will pay up to $21 billion over 18 years, and Johnson & Johnson will pay up to $5 billion over 9 years, $3.7 billion of that in the first 3 years. Attorney General Josh Call has until August 20th to sign off on this deal. So, JR, we've been dealing with this for a long time in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. The legislature has passed a lot of bills to deal with opioid drug abuse over the years. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss put out a statement talking about the bipartisan support that Act 57 received. Mm-hmm. What are the politics behind this? Do you think this is, how is this money going to go? Who's going to benefit from it the most?
Yeah, so remember, this is $400 million for the state from this pot of money. Mm-hmm. There were two other settlements that have been announced related to opioids. We're talking about $500 million so far for Wisconsin, roughly.
Okay.
With this settlement, Call said it does fall under a new law that Republicans passed and Evers signed.
Okay.
That divvies it up. 70% of the money goes to the counties and 30% to the state. So the counties are thrilled to see this money coming down the pipe. If everything works out the way it's supposed to, mm-hmm. to help address the cost that they've incurred dealing with this. It's interesting, too, that, remember, Evers signed the bill with that separation of funds, even though he said he believed the Joint Finance Committee's role, where that committee would have oversight of the mm-hmm. settlement, was unconstitutional.
That's right. Yeah.
And Call opposed the bill, but they didn't want to risk the money, so they went ahead and signed it anyway to get this thing going, because these things are coming down the pipe. Mm-hmm. You're talking big dollars for counties who have suffered significant expenses dealing with this crisis for years.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, we're going to go on to, I'd say, a topic that most everyone in Wisconsin is probably aware of this week. The Bucks, they won a big championship. So we're going to talk about Fear the Deer, how this all came about. I know you remember this.
Yes.
So the 2014, the Bucks consider leaving Milwaukee. This debate about a new stadium begins. Herb Cole steps up, says he'll sell the team, but he turns around and invests or donates $100 million of that, as well as there's more that comes in from the new owners to put towards that. Now it's up to the lawmakers to approve a $250 million match to complete the new stadium. Scott Walker, our former governor, notoriously starts the slogan, "It's cheaper to keep them." And that proves successful. There's bipartisan support and opposition. The GOP pretty much are big fans of this, building the new stadium. Dem support is kind of split, big from the Milwaukee area. The new stadium officially opens in 2017, 2018. I think it's worth noting that in 2020, the team becomes real intertwined with the events that are happening in their own backyard. They boycott games after the shooting of Jacob Blake. And then here we are this week. The Bucks win the NBA championship, first time in 50 years. So, yeah, was this all worth it, JR?
This story of the Bucks is intertwined with politics, unlike most sports stories, in a unique way. I mean, from Herb Cole owning them to Scott Walker coming with this plan to, cheaper to keep them.
Yeah.
The votes to, don't forget, Alex Lazary is running for U.S. Senate in Wisconsin, and probably wouldn't be running for U.S. Senate if his dad hadn't been part of the ownership team that bought the Bucks.
Yeah.
So it's just really interesting how intertwined it is with politics. And, oh, by the way, Lazary's father, Mark, was a giant donor to Hillary Clinton 2016 campaign. Oh, yeah, there's all kinds of politics involved.
I did not know
with this.
That one.
So it's been interesting. One of the arguments about the stadium back in 2015 when this bill was going through was, well, why should taxpayers be putting anything up for people, billionaires, to build a new arena?
Mm-hmm.
The argument that Walker made was, look, if you look at the income tax Wisconsin collects off of players' salaries, that would be lost revenue if you don't have the Bucks in town. Various states have laws that even when athletes come through town to play, they get taxed for what they make while they're playing in your backyard. They're all kind. You have to have a very good accountant if you're a professional athlete in many sports in many states. But there's a cut of the income tax that we would lose if we didn't have the Bucks in Wisconsin. Not to mention the employees of the team, mm-hmm. Those who work at the stadium, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, and the Deer District itself, we didn't have anything like that when the Bradley Center was in place. It's just...
No, and don't forget they tore down a Parkway East as part, years ago. It opened up this area for development. This has become a hot spot. And then you look at what you saw in Milwaukee on Tuesday with They planned for 65,000. They maybe had 100,000, depending on what estimate you want to believe, that were downtown. That's an opportunity for Milwaukee. Also, it puts Milwaukee on the national stage.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, by the way, we're coming out of a pandemic where the entertainment district really took it in the shorts. And you had this huge influx of people coming downtown. And being Wisconsin, drinking a lot of beer while they're down there, you know, and filling bars. I mean, it's got all these, again, great for the Bucks. They won this championship. But there's also these kind of wave effects of politics and economics that are a big deal in Wisconsin and for the city of Milwaukee.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, politics on this one are definitely intertwined. So, but anyways, congrats, Bucks. But we'll go to your stock picks now. So who do we have rising this week?
The Dem Senate field. So, look, we talked about Barnes and his entrance into the race and kind of like his dynamic. Don't forget, we're at basically 10 people who are in. Stephen LaCara, who is the founder of Millennium Action Project, has not yet announced. He's at exploratory phase. But add him in, more than half of the field would be from Milwaukee. The latest official entrance is Shantia Lewis, who's an alderman from Milwaukee. Interesting. She had a great rollout video the day after Mandela Barnes announced. She pitched herself as a mom, a fighter, an Air Force vet, turning from the first black woman in Wisconsin to become a U.S. senator. But think about the timing. Her candidacy was rumored, talked about for weeks, if not months, she was going to get in. Okay, so she's trying to get in after Emily's List already endorsed Sarah Galuski, which is a huge, huge group for female candidates who support abortion rights.
Yep.
They raise money for you. They also do stuff. I'm not saying that Shantia Lewis could have gotten that endorsement, but if she'd gotten in earlier, maybe could have given that group a little pause.
Yeah, perhaps they would have.
Dr. Bettino up in Wausau, she's also in, female candidate. She didn't. And was just in, like, bat an eye about that, endorsing Galuski. Shantia Lewis's announcement was overshadowed by Barnes, because Barnes is also trying to be the first black U.S. senator from Wisconsin. So you look at these people who are running besides that top tier of Barnes, Galuski, Lazary, and else a little bit. You go, what's their path? Chris Larson, for example, another person from Milwaukee. Can he raise the money to, like, make himself a credible candidate? Now, you could argue that anybody getting in, they have the chance to raise their profile, build some name ID, maybe help them run for something else down the line. But as far as like this race, this dynamic, you kind of go, okay, what's your path? And then you all start doing the math. If you have six candidates from Milwaukee, and, you know, like, I don't care what these candidates pull in terms of votes. Every vote you pull out of Milwaukee is one less for a Lazary or a Barnes, for example, to pull out of Milwaukee. They're both the more high-profile Milwaukee candidates. How's that going to play? And, oh, by the way, there are sometimes national forces at play where they say big primaries and try and clear the field, right?
Yeah.
Might you see national Democrats say, hey, this is going to get messy. We want to try and maybe limit the field a little bit. That can be dicey. And, oh, by the way, all these Democratic candidates, how do they differentiate themselves? They're all going to be, like, on the issues right in the same ballpark, right? Maybe not the same base, but the same
pretty close,
ballpark.
Yeah.
So then do you attack each other? Do you have the Constitution and the resources to go after each other? Oh, by the way, if you attack this candidate, his or her supporters aren't going to forget that. So you have to have not have your fingerprints on it. And then you, if you're Democrats, you have between August, is it 9th of 2022, until the first week of November, to coalesce the support of the people you just tore down in a primary. I know I'm talking a lot, but that's a lot of stuff going on. And Republicans are going, this would be awesome.
Well, I was going to say,
have a wide open, nasty primary.
Do you want to use this opportunity to talk about Ron Johnson's statements? I mean, why not?
Yeah.
This week?
So Ron Johnson this week, and people, it caught people's attention, but it's not really that different than what he's been saying before, which is... he's not sure he'd be the best candidate to run in 2022. He also said, look, I ran on getting rid of Obamacare and cutting the deficit. We haven't made progress on either of those two things. So he's not sure his term has been a success. Now, people made a lot of that, but that's what Johnson's been kind of saying for a while, at least about whether he'd run again. What I've been told for months is that Ron Johnson will sit down at some point and make a calculation of, okay, do I have a path to win? I'm in the best person to hold this seat because he, his main concern is that Republicans hold on to that Senate seat and hold on, and keep at, whether they're at in the Senate or take back control of the Senate next year. If he's not the best person to do that, he'd step aside. Well, if he doesn't, if he keeps waiting.
Then who is? And if his main thing is, you know, we want to keep this seat in Wisconsin, GOP seat, then...
Well, interesting thing you bring up. If you look at the members of Congress right now, Mike Gallagher up in Green Bay, he keeps raising money hand over fist. He's got a very big bank account. So if you are a Mike Gallagher and Ron Johnson decides, let's just pull early 2022 out of a hat. Let's say it's March, just for the heck of it. You've been raising money at a pretty healthy clip. You can transition from running for re-election in the House to the Senate. No problem. Kevin Nicholson, though, is a different story. Remember, Kevin Nicholson ran for U.S. Senate 2018. He's been out with his No Better Friend group, kind of going around Wisconsin, talking about issues and pushing the conservative cause, also building kind of credentials with conservative base. Because in 2018, he lacked a connection with the conservative base. It went, we're not sure about you. You used to be the president of College Democrats back in like 2000. Mm-hmm. Are you for real? What's going on? Well, he's got a decision to make. He might want to run for governor. He might want to run for U.S. Senate. The longer Johnson takes, the harder it is for Nicholson to make a decision, because can you wait until Ron Johnson makes a call and then jump in that race? Or do you go say, I'm going to run for governor? Can you switch over? Again, a lot of complicated factors.
Johnson's got to decide. A lot of people are waiting to move these little puzzle pieces.
Ron Johnson says, I'm in no hurry, and I'm not going to be pressured, because remember Ron Johnson in 2010? He announced in like April that he was running. It was very late in the cycle, and he believes that can be replicated.
Yeah. Well, I think we thoroughly covered the Senate race.
Oh, we've got so much more we could talk about, though.
I know. It could be a whole show. What about the mixed? Who gets mixed reviews this week, JR?
Clean Energy Alliance this week put out kind of its annual report saying, hey, we cut down on how many the gases we emitted, the water that we used, all these great things. Same time, three-fourths of its power still generated by fossil fuels.
Okay.
It kind of underscores, when we talk about moving to renewable resources, the challenge.
Okay.
We're using less coal in Wisconsin, but we're still coal-reliant.
Yeah.
Those are things to kind of keep an eye on. Oh, by the way, on the solar front, there's a coalition of groups getting together to build support for a bill that would allow businesses and residents to invest in private community solar gardens, which is a way to generate solar energy. So there's all kinds of stuff moving, but we're still a long way from being, you know, a renewable energy type state down the line.
Yeah. So who's getting the big thumbs down this week, JR?
So DNR appointments. I live in the weeds, Jessica, in my job.
You really do live in the weeds.
And one thing I saw this week was that Senate Republican leadership sent the appointments of two DNR board members to Senate organization. Now, why is that important? A couple things. One, there's a Wausau dentist, Dr. Prain, who has refused to vacate his seat on the DNR board.
Yep.
Why is that important? Well, if he leaves and Evers appointee replaces him, it becomes a 4-3 Evers majority in the DNR board. The hitch is there has been a precedent set that if you are on a board and your replacement has been confirmed by the state Senate, you can kind of keep serving. It doesn't happen very often.
Okay.
It has happened before. So Prain's saying, I'm not leaving, even though his term is up May 1st, because of that. He also says it's because he had received critical coverage by a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel columnist, and he's getting death threats and stuff like that, et cetera, et cetera. Yes.
Jeez.
Now,
okay.
There are two Walker appointees whose terms ended May 1st. The other one left quietly. The Evers appointee replaced her on the board, so it's still 4-3 Walker appointees. Prain's not leaving. That means Sandra Nass, who is an Ashland teacher, can't take her spot on the board. By taking these appointments and going to Senate org, it means they're basically bottled up.
Jeez.
They're not moving through the committee process. Now, the question answers I've had this week is, why Senate org? Senate org typically meets, it does stuff by paper ballot. And what happens is their leadership's on that committee. They set the calendar, for example, take care of travel requests, things like that, by paper ballot.
Okay.
You get a paper ballot, you fill out yes or no, you send it back in by a certain deadline, there's your meeting. It's met once in person this year. And that was because they wanted finance to hear a bill, but realized that finance couldn't meet and move it to org because the people who were there can do it quickly.
Okay.
It's not a body that has public hearings. Usually nominations have public hearings and votes. Okay, so now what? Now you have two animal rights groups asking Josh Call to try and forcibly remove Dr. Prain from the DNR board. They argue that that precedent stems from a Supreme Court decision that doesn't really apply to this situation, and that in other state statutes about other boards, there's clear, unambiguous language that you can stay on until a replacement's confirmed. But the DNR board appointments, the language is you cannot stay on after term expires. Now Wisconsin Manufacturing Commerce has jumped in the fray saying, we want Dr. Prain to stay, not rubber stamp the bureaucracy, we think he's an independent voice. Look, take all this craziness aside, this is an example of how government doesn't really work anymore in Wisconsin. So tradition has been that elections have consequences. Evers won. He gets to pick the member to the board. Dr. Prem would leave. But we're now in more of a power struggle situation.
Yeah, I mean, this is a crazy situation for people just to be hanging on to their seats. You said two of them should have left their seats on May 1st.
And one did.
So
now, I have seen, go back 20 years almost, then Senator Leader Chuck Koala, or Senate Democrats at the time, I can't remember who was in charge of 2002. But anyway, Democrats were in charge of the state Senate. They did not approve a bunch of appointments by then Governor Tommy Thompson and Scott McCallum. Remember, McCallum replaced Thompson in 01. Two opposing Board of Regents refused to leave their seats because they basically got the runaround from Senate Democrats.
Okay.
And so when Jim Doyle took office, he rescinded all these appointments to try to place his own people, and they said, no, we're not leaving because of that. So that happened before, but this is a little bit different because you don't have the party wait. So the nominees are the ones. It's a little bit different situation.
Yeah.
But that said, if you're governor now, do you appoint more combative people to boards going forward? Because the DNR board, look, they're partisan, but they're not overt partisans necessarily. But do you, if you're a governor, do you say, well, these are going to be real fights going on every session and appoint more partisan people? Then do you see the politics that we have in the Capitol filtering down to these boards going forward and being a little more, you know, combative?
Yeah. Speaking of really partisan news, but not really. What are our thoughts, JR, on whether Aaron Rodgers is going to return to the Green Bay Packers this year? You know, I'm kind of moving back up to Green Bay next week for a new job. So, I mean,
no comment.
I'll go with the no comment, too. But I'd like to see him return. Can I say that?
Go ahead.
Okay, I'd like to see him return. All right, so that's kind of a wrap on this week's show of Rewind. I'd like to take this moment just to say that next Friday we'll be on vacation, so we'll be skipping a week of the show. But again, I'm Jessica Van Egren.
I'm J.R. Ross.
And this was Rewind for the week of July 23rd. Have a great weekend.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.